Hi, this is Gordon Deal. The Wall Street Journal this weekend starts right after this. Wix.com lets you easily create a beautiful professional website for free. With hundreds of stunning templates, cool features, and popular apps, you can get your business online today. Start now at Wix.com. That's Wix.com.
Direct from the newsroom of the Wall Street Journal. The Wall Street Journal this weekend with Gordon Deal.
From Ukraine to Gaza to the South China Sea, President Obama is dealing with an arc of instability some say we haven't seen since the 1970s. I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal with Gina Cervetti in this hour.
Recent world events are posing a serious challenge to the president's foreign policy.
Prosecutors have changed their tune on corporate punishment, and some say they've gone soft on big corporations.
Getting rid of cable. More and more Americans are doing it. We'll tell you the best ways to cut the cord.
And would you keep working if you won the lottery?
77% said they'd keep working because they would just be bored if they had nothing to do. And I think that's a very honest answer. I think that really plays into just the enjoying where they're working and enjoying their coworkers. I think it's important. It shows that the workforce is strong.
All that and more on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. 7 minutes after the hour, I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal this week. A convergence of security crises is playing out around the globe, from Ukraine to the Palestinian territories and Iraq to the South China Sea, and it's posing a serious challenge to President Obama's foreign policy. In fact, some say the breadth of global instability now unfolding has not been seen since the late 1970s. Joining us now to discuss is Jay Solomon, a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And Jay, how do we get to this point?
It's a complicated history over the last 10 years. Probably a mix of the invasion of Iraq, the Arab Spring, economic problems in the U.S. We think there's sort of a convergence where the U.S. has been pulling back in some ways from its muscular role in the Middle East and in Asia, and that coupled with massive instability, unleashed by the Arab Spring, the changing, shifting of borders in the Middle East, the rising foreign policy powers of China, Russia, the aggressiveness of Iran, has really put the situation where the structure that has been kind of in place since the Cold War is increasingly being tested, which explains why you see so much instability right now.
You also write in your article that some of our allies in Europe especially are not making it any easier for us. How so?
Yeah, I mean, you see that over the last few months where the Russians have really pushed in Ukraine. They annexed Crimea, and the U.S. has been trying to support Ukraine, some of our allies in the Baltic states. And to do that, we've really wanted to punish Putin for that through sanctions. And we have imposed some, but they've not been nearly as aggressive as many in the Obama administration has hoped for. And that's because many of the European countries didn't want to go along. They were worried about their business interests in Russia. They were worried about provoking Moscow. And that's why you don't see the sanctions that many had hoped for. And the Russians are still moving weapons, arms, and intelligence officers into eastern Ukraine.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Jay Solomon in Washington. Is it fair to say that there are some parallels between the way we felt about intervening in foreign matters, both in the 70s with Vietnam and today, coming off wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, definitely Obama campaigned when he came in to roll back these wars. That's what he was elected on. We had economic troubles, and it's difficult to finance it. People are very critical of Obama, but they also kind of forget the context of which he came in and what he was voted on. And I think, yeah, after the Vietnam War, there was a similar tendency not to want to get embroiled in messy overseas conflicts and focus on restoring the economy. So I do think there are parallels. It's a difficult situation if you're some of the American allies, because they are getting very kind of nervous about China's push into the South China Sea, challenging control over territories there. The Russians on the fringes of Europe, in the Middle East, it's just, you can see the rise of these Sunni militias in Iraq and Syria and the threats they pose to our allies there. It's a dangerous mix of us pulling back while these either rogue states or, contesting states or not even states, militias are challenging the order. And that's why it's such a dangerous time.
You said that President Obama did not campaign a lot on foreign policy. How does this affect the last few years of Mr. Obama's presidency?
Despite all these challenges, he really has stuck to his campaign promises of 2008, maybe to a fault. At times he has discussed, last year he he was pretty much mapping out an operation to bomb the regime of President Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and then he pulled back, which a lot of our allies, U.S. allies, thought was a terrible signal, because if you make that commitment and then don't do it, you embolden your enemies in a lot of ways. I don't think we're going to see that much of a shift by Obama. I mean, he had very aggressive diplomacy by Secretary of State Kerry and to try to resolve these disputes, but there's no talk, really, of much military engagement. He's sticking to that. With Islamic militia taking huge chunks of Iraq in recent weeks, and over the past 5 or 6 weeks, there's been talk about airstrikes, but that's kind of rolled back too. I think what we're seeing is diplomatic efforts to strengthen the government in Baghdad, with the hope that that government, their military, could push back this militia.
All right, thank you, J.J. Solomon of the Wall Street Journal. 11 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend.
TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free guaranteed savings. Some features are not available in all states. In the first 3 months of this year, over 126,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. True Car users save an average of $3,078 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking for. Then register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your True Car savings certificate and take it to the True Car certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Remember, every day, True Car users receive negotiation-free guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Prosecutors who have extracted multi-billion dollar fines from Citigroup and other big banks say they're trying to deter future corporate wrongdoing by making shareholders angry enough to demand changes. It's a significant shift in tone for the Justice Department and the FBI. For years, they had argued that sending people to prison is the best way to prevent white-collar crime. Wall Street Journal reporter Devlin Barrett has been following this seeming change in outlook and joins us today to discuss it. Devlin, how has this trend manifested itself?
In the last month, we've seen two separate press conferences where both the head of the FBI, Jim Comey, and the head of the Justice Department, Attorney General Eric Holder, have argued that there is a powerful deterrence in imposing huge fines on corporations. Specifically, they were talking about a guilty plea by the French bank BNP Paribas, which had to pay close to $9 billion in one case, and a $7 billion settlement with Citigroup. And in both cases, the head of the FBI and the head of the Justice Department argued that those financial penalties were deterrents to wrongdoing in the corporate world because shareholders should get angry at the bottom line costs to the companies they've invested in and force changes at the firm.
A lot of people might not take that at face value. A lot of people think people should have gone to jail for the financial crisis that we had, and that by and large has not happened. And here we have two of the top officials of the government saying that they prefer these civil penalties.
That's been the key criticism of the Justice Department as it's looked at what happened leading up to the financial crisis. And what's most interesting about it to me is that one of the people making this argument is Jim Comey, who as a prosecutor spent years arguing that real deterrence comes from sending people to jail. Mr. Comey used to be the U.S. attorney, the federal prosecutor in Manhattan, and he sent WorldCom executives to jail. He even sent, frankly, low-level employees of WorldCom to jail for their roles in the accounting fraud that went on there. And he has spent a career basically making the argument that prison time is the best deterrent, and undercutting the potential of prison time weakens the deterrent message. So it was pretty interesting to me to hear him making the argument that a financial penalty paid on a corporation is a deterrent.
Is anybody venturing an opinion as to why Holder and Comey have come out with these statements?
I spoke to some folks who sort of study corporate fraud and the enforcement of it. In particular, there's a professor at Columbia University who said, look, this notion that shareholders are going to exact a price of the company is just misguided, because shareholders don't have they have power, but it's very diffuse, and they can't collectively decide to force a company to do very much. There's just not that sort of uniformity and direction to, the vast number of shareholders in a major company like Citigroup.
So where is this heading?
Well, look, I think we're right now seeing sort of a summer of settlements with banks, meaning the attorney general is likely to leave, say, later this year or sometime soon after that. And I think there's a lot of these cases he would like to resolve. So next, we're likely to see either a settlement or a lawsuit regarding Bank of America and its mortgage securities. And there's a whole host of, you know, big banks, but banks that which are essentially lesser players in that period's mortgage market, who will also have to, you know, settle or come to terms in some form, either with a lawsuit or with a settlement, with the government as this year progresses. I do think that the more time that goes on, the more clear it is to everyone that no one is likely to be charged criminally with any of the conduct. As much as that's something that officials don't really like to talk about when they make these announcements, it's the question that keeps coming up. So I don't think that dynamic is going to change, however many billions more come rolling in the next few months.
And I hate to harp on the same issue, but many of these same government officials, when they leave government, will either go to work for corporate America or go to work for the law firms that service corporate America. Is there anything to be made in that connection?
Well, right. And that's, I think that's one of the reasons and one of the suspicions behind the criticism that the Justice Department hasn't prosecuted any senior executives for what happened leading up to the crisis. I think it's very hard to come down with a definitive answer on that. It's certainly true that many of the lawyers who run the Justice Department now are going to become corporate lawyers again and were corporate lawyers before. And does that color their judgment? I think it's a completely fair question. I think it's a difficult one to ultimately answer because it says you have to look into their hearts.
All right, Devlin Barrett of the Wall Street Journal, thanks very much for joining us. Coming up on 20 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend, time now for Gina Cervetti.
Housing market numbers grab our attention in the coming week. Economist Joel Naroff says he expects to hear that sales ticked higher last month, especially in terms of sales of previously owned properties.
I would be disappointed if we didn't get something over 4.9 million and really closer to 5 million.
The coming days also bring the latest look at our consumer prices, an important measure of inflation. Jobless claims slipped in the latest week with a total that was better than what economists expecting, but housing starts for June were disappointing, with construction plunging 9%.
They were up in the Northeast, they were up in the Midwest, they were up in the West, but they fell sharply in the South. Unfortunately, I don't have a good reason for that, but in most of the country, starts were actually up, except for that big drop in the South.
David Burson is with Nationwide Economics. Health officials in Florida say two people have contracted a mosquito-borne virus locally, the first confirmed cases in which the disease was acquired in the continental U.S. rather than overseas. The chikungunya virus has spread rapidly through the Caribbean since first being identified in December. This next week in Houston, a unit of General Electric plans to test wearable devices such as Google Glass, along with drones for possible use in company operations. An official with GE's Power Generation Services Unit says 10 engineers will be in Houston for an innovation camp. KBB.com has zeroed in on some cars that it says offer both fuel efficiency and won't break the bank, including the 2015 Honda Fit, this year's Toyota Prius V hybrid, and the Ford C-Max hybrid 2014 model year. KBB's other fuel economy stars include the Chevy Spark EV and the Nissan Pathfinder hybrid, both 2014s, and all of these cars mentioned cost less than $36,000. New rules in Washington state say it's okay to sell marijuana cookies and brownies, but not lollipops or other candies that might appeal to kids. The state's Liquor Control Board this past week published new guidelines on marijuana edibles after Washington became the second U.S. state to allow recreational pot sales.
I'm not sure what to say about that story, but...
So the cookies and the brownies, they're okay. The lollipops are out.
Just don't bring them into the office. Thank you, Gina. Coming up on 26 past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend, I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal. Wall Street Journal personal technology columnist Jeffrey Fowler says he's a little ashamed to admit his cable bill for this month was more than $200. But all he really wants is HBO plus his internet connection and a landline phone. Instead, he says he's paying for endless hours of Kardashians. And like many Americans, he's been considering cutting the cord on cable TV. Today, about one in five Americans lives without cable. So that got him to exploring how to go about cutting the cord. He joins us today to tell us how. Jeffrey, what are some of the ways people are already cutting the cord?
I hadn't thought about antennas since 1985. You know, think of those giant clunky things either on top of a TV or on top of the roof of a house. But in 2009, all aerial signals in the U.S. went digital, and many of your biggest local broadcast stations actually also broadcast in HD, which means that you can actually get a picture for free over the air that might be even better, higher quality, more crisp than what you're getting through your cable provider. To do all this, of course, you need an antenna. Antennas, though, have also changed. They've gotten a lot smaller, and they've gotten a lot better. I tested out a couple, and in one of our tests, we were able to get 99 different channels in perfect clarity. For my own house in San Francisco, it did pretty well, but I couldn't actually get our local NBC station because I happened to live in a dead zone for it. So for me to do it, I'd actually have to go for a rooftop model. But still, there's a lot of TV you can get for free out there with just an antenna.
You also write that some people are using the Slingbox to bypass cable. Tell us some more about what it does.
They were the original TV over the internet company, and they're relaunching themselves with two new products this week that make it kind of easier and cheaper than ever to basically attach this little box to somebody's cable box and then beam it over the internet to your phone, your tablet, or your TV. This would work particularly well for folks who have maybe a kid in college and they don't want to pay for cable, or for folks with like a second home. And basically what it does is plugs into the back of a cable box that somebody is paying for, and then it beams that signal over the internet, and then you can really watch it pretty much anywhere. And in my tests, it worked pretty well. I was able to watch the World Cup at a buddy's house who is a cable cutter. We just beamed it from my phone to his Apple TV, and there we were watching it.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal reporter Jeffrey Fowler. Jeffrey, you also write that consumers should only pay for what they want, right?
That's right. So increasingly, the sort of the trend is that producers of entertainment are more and more willing to sell it over the internet directly to consumers. Certainly not everyone, but more of it than you might think. And so it's maybe time to do a census, you know, see how much would it cost if you like wrote down all the shows you actually watch? How much would it cost to either buy them, you know, a la carte from services like iTunes, or subscribe to services like Netflix or Hulu Plus that make them available? When I did that kind of census, actually, I found that even with the cost of my internet bill, it was still about half of what I was spending on my total package from Comcast. So that's not a bad way to go.
Why should consumers find a login?
Well, the sort of the last option here is that there are certain companies that refuse to sell their programming directly to consumers, and those happen to be some of the most popular producers of programming, HBO and ESPN. So if you want to get access to their services online, you have to subscribe to cable, or at least somebody you know has to. It's kind of one of these gray areas of being a digital consumer.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Jeffrey Fowler of the Wall Street Journal. Coming up on 30 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend, Brazil's World Cup was never going to be simple. We'll recap the games for you.
Is there a voice in your head saying, you can do better with your finances? Well, know that you can do better. Save more for retirement and reduce costly broker and mutual fund fees with a free, easy, and secure tool called Personal Capital. In one place, Personal Capital aggregates all of your accounts like your 401k and IRA, shows how much you're overpaying in fees and how to reduce those fees. You also get tailored advice on optimizing your investments. That's the personal in Personal Capital. When you're ready, Personal Capital will assign an expert advisor to you to talk about how to make the most of your investments, both by helping to optimize your portfolio and reduce your fees. Take the first easy step. Go to personalcapital.com/WSJ to check if you're overpaying on your annual investment fees. Signing up takes just a minute. Personal Capital gives you total clarity and transparency to make better investment decisions on the web or on your smartphone or tablet. To set up your free account, go to personalcapital.com/WSJ. That's personalcapital.com/WSJ.
Powered by the most trusted name in journalism, you're listening to the Wall Street Journal this weekend.
It's 34 minutes after the hour. I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal, along with Gina Cervetti. Coming up in this half hour, there's a shift in how doctors are fighting Alzheimer's. They want to prevent it before it manifests itself. NFL kickers go to their summer boot camp. We'll take you along. And would you keep working if you won the lottery? All that and more straight ahead on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Well, they had a soccer tournament and the best team won, right? Well, maybe not so. If only the 2014 World Cup in Brazil were as simple as that. Instead, we got complex mixtures in this World Cup. A player biting controversy, an embarrassing collapse by the host team, a surge in interest in soccer here in the U.S. You can find all these stories in a new e-book by the reporters of the Wall Street Journal, who originally reported them. It's titled The Unforgettable World Cup. It's available to download for free at WSJ.com. And joining us now to put this past World Cup in perspective is Wall Street Journal reporter Jason Gay. Jason, tell us about this e-book.
This is definitely a collaboration among a bunch of really, really terrific Wall Street Journal reporters who have been following this World Cup, not just for the month that has already taken place in Brazil, but really for years heading into this World Cup, because as we know, it's just such an epic endeavor that people start covering this thing years out.
You write that the romance of this World Cup in Brazil was easy.
Yeah, I mean, look, if someone offered you the opportunity to have gone to Brazil to see this, it's just a natural, right? An unbelievably passionate soccer country, an unbelievably successful, influential place. Plus, Brazil, Copacabana, Rio, Ipanema, what's not to love? It had all that attractive aspect to it, but then you had a real reconsideration in Brazil. And heading into this World Cup, there was a lot of conversation about the wisdom or the lack of wisdom of spending so many billions of dollars on soccer stadia for a place that had serious issues with regard to, you know, poverty, healthcare, education, infrastructure. Was soccer such an important thing that Brazil could set everything aside and spend so much money for it?
Fair to say Brazil has some regrets?
I think so. You know, I think we're living in an interesting era now where these global sporting events, where there's such a demand to build massive stadiums, roadways, transportation to make them happen for such a limited window of time. In the case of the World Cup, 4 weeks. In the case of the Olympics, 2 weeks. I think there's a good deal of hesitation, and I think it's wise hesitation about jumping into these things.
You talk about the reconsideration of holding these big, huge events. I understand Brazil spent $11 billion on this. If Brazil had won the tournament, would we not be talking about that?
I don't think the fact that, you know, whether or not the team wins the championship puts aside the question of wisdom of expenditure. Does it diminish it slightly? Probably. There was some expectation that we were going to see big protests in Brazil during the World Cup. That largely didn't present itself. However, at the same time, there is a growing belief among not just people who are engaged in politics and civil disobedience, but people in sports, people who are passionate about sports, about just the crazy amount of money that gets spent around these events. I mean, we saw it even here in New York, something like the Super Bowl, what types of shutdown, things have to happen, and the prioritization or the warp prioritizations that have to happen around big time sports in this country. We see it all the time.
You and your colleagues followed the World Cup very closely. From your perspective, what is the legacy of these games?
There's just a certain kind of irresistible quality to the World Cup. You know, it's very easy to be cynical about sport in the modern era. We see, again, just grotesque expenditures that happen. We see the kind of crazy hype machine that happens around sports that's generated by the media and so on. And then you get down to the actual games. You get down to the moments where the players are on the pitch, the fans are in the stands, and the millions are watching around the world. And you truly feel at a World Cup, unlike any other sporting event, that you are in the center of the sports. This is a truly global event that is deeply passionate in every sector of the planet. And there's nothing like that.
Sure is. Jason Gay, thanks for joining us. 41 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. I'm John Metaxas, in for Gordon Deal. Earlier is better. It's become a mantra in the field of Alzheimer's disease. Experts are targeting the prevention or delay of memory decline more instead of just focusing on treating patients who already have manifested the disease. Results from one of the largest prevention trials ever were presented this week at a conference in Copenhagen. Reporter Shirley Wong joins us with the details of these latest findings. And Shirley, these studies looked at what is known as cognitive impairment. What do we mean by that?
Well, cognitive impairment is a technical term, but loosely speaking, it just means when people are starting to notice they're having trouble with their memory. And this is to distinguish when someone has full-blown dementia or Alzheimer's disease where they meet some kind of clinical requirement that says they have diagnosis.
Right. And scientists have been studying the early stages of this impairment, correct?
That's right. Scientists are interested more and more on trying to get disease early, and that means when people are starting just to notice the very, very earliest memory symptoms, or ideally one day before they develop memory symptoms. And the reason for this is because they think that intervening earlier will yield better improvements and effects for patients.
In other words, prevention might be more effective than attempting a reversal.
Exactly.
So what kind of trials have been going on, and what kind of information has come out?
So there are a number of prevention trials that are underway that are looking at either trying to change people's lifestyle activities, exercise, diet, social activities, brain training activities, or trying to use experimental medications in hopes that these medications given early enough in individuals will actually help slow or even prevent memory symptoms from developing. A lot of these are still in the early stages, and so there aren't results yet, but lots and lots of researchers are very interested in trying to move earlier on in the disease, because treating people as they have severe memory problems already is very difficult.
So there is a thought that lifestyle can play a role in this.
Absolutely. There were study findings, large trials in Finland that showed probably the largest randomized controlled trial of lifestyle intervention to date, that showed that patients who were instructed and helped to make a bunch of changes to their lifestyle, again, including diet, exercise, social activities, treating their cholesterol and high blood pressure, over a two-year time period compared to people in a control group that only got some basic general health advice, those individuals in the intervention group seemed to have better cognition at the end of the 2 years compared to the control group. So there's some suggestion that these like kinds of lifestyle changes over time may help prevent memory decline.
And the other wing of the study you talked about, medication, what are the thoughts behind that?
So there are a number of trials that are looking at different kinds of experimental treatments. A lot of them focus on a type of medicine that attacks a protein that is known to clump in the brains of people with Alzheimer's called amyloid. And these amyloid plaques, people think, are contributing to the disease, though it's somewhat of a debate in the field. So a number of these experimental medications are trying to either remove the plaques from the brain or stop or slow them from forming in the first place. And the trials that have been conducted in people with more moderate or severe illness have not worked. And so researchers think, well, since the pathology of Alzheimer's develops upwards of 20 or 30 years before people start showing memory symptoms, let's start earlier. So they're hoping that these experimental treatments in a setting where people either have mild cognitive symptoms or they have no symptoms yet at all might help prevent the onset of these types of symptoms.
All right. Thank you, Shirley. Shirley Wong of the Wall Street Journal.
At 30,000 feet, there's no room for error. To keep a modern fighter jet flying safely year after year requires a highly trained team of expert technicians and specialized equipment.
Echo 311 confirming final inspection. Roger that.
GMC certified service technicians take service and maintenance just as seriously.
And we'll do a full 27-point inspection.
Great, thanks.
With specialized GMC training and genuine parts for every GMC vehicle, you can be sure your GMC is always ready to take off. Incredible thinking, incredible service. GMC certified service. That's professional grade. Get AC Delco Professional DuraStop brake pads installed for only $99.95 or less per axle. Includes rotor inspection. Retail customers only. Turning or replacing rotors, all other services and tax extra. Visit GMCCertifiedService.com for details, other great offers, and to find your closest GMC dealer.
48 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. I'm John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal. And if you won the lottery, would you keep working? Well, a surprising number of Americans say they would. The Wall Street Journal's Matthew Passy joins us now with more.
Well, John, according to a new survey from CareerBuilder.com, more than half of us would go into the office even if we didn't need the money.
I think that really plays into just the enjoying where they're working and enjoying their coworkers. I think it's important. It shows that the workforce is strong.
CareerBuilder's senior career advisor Michael Irwin goes on to explain why so many of us would keep punching the clock.
77% said they'd keep working because they would just be bored if they had nothing to do. And I think that's a very honest answer.
Boredom, though, wasn't the only reason we'd give for wanting to keep showing up at the office.
76% said it gives them a sense of purpose and accomplishment. 42% said they would like to have a little more financial security. And then the most important, I think, is 23% said that they would just miss their coworkers and they'd miss that camaraderie.
Which really does highlight the fact, the importance of the workplace for so many right now.
people enjoy their jobs. That worker satisfaction number is higher. We see that year over year. And I think it really talks to, money isn't everything. Money will make it a lot easier for you, but you still need to have those personal relationships and people want to stay in the office.
And John, among those who would take the money and run, 48% said they would give 2 weeks' notice but stay on longer until a replacement was found. 31% would give the 2 weeks' notice and leave after that. 13% would resign effective immediately. Just 3% said they would tell their boss off and air all of their grievances. And 2%, well, they would just never show up again. I guess it just depends on how much that winning ticket was worth, John.
Oh, I think that's right. Let me say at the outset, I love working here, but depending on how much money it was, I think I might leave too.
Yeah, 2 weeks might be just enough.
No, I definitely would not walk out the door. All right, thanks. Matthew Passy reporting. 50 minutes past the hour on the Wall Street Journal this weekend. Time now for Gina Cervetti.
And this next week brings the latest update on orders for so-called durables, those long-lasting big-ticket items. Everything from our appliances to motor vehicles. Economist Joel Naroff expects an increase.
Fundamentally, the economy is moving forward, so we should see something in the range of about 0.5% or so, which really would represent a solid gain in durable orders.
Worldwide economic growth is expected to come in at 2.7% for the year, according to a new report from Dun & Bradstreet. The firm projects growth of 3.3% next year, but points to potential headwinds, including rising interest rates and debt burdens. Well, as you might suspect, adding a teenage driver to your insurance policy can boost your costs. Laura Adams with InsuranceQuotes.com says crash rates among teenage drivers are 3 times higher than those for older motorists.
Insurance companies are seeing the statistics on this. They know that teen drivers, whether they're male or female, are just more prone to get into accidents.
That means adding a teen driver to a married couple's policy boosts your premiums by 79% annually, 92% if the driver is a male, 67% for your teenage daughter. When it comes to hotel stays, we're more satisfied with those stays, says J.D. Power and Associates. The Four Seasons, Holiday Inn, and Microtel by Wyndham scored best in their respective categories from luxury to budget. Millennials tended to be the pickiest when it came to their hotel experiences. Amazon is offering an unlimited reading and audiobook listening service that will work with your Kindle and non-Amazon branded devices. It'll cost around $10 a month after a 30-day free trial, and analysts expect the service could add as much as $1 billion in revenue for Amazon. And this weekend marks 45 years since One Giant Leap for Mankind, the famous words spoken by Neil Armstrong as he stepped onto the moon. Fellow Apollo 11 astronaut Buzz Aldrin followed him onto the lunar surface. The third crewmate was Michael Collins. Armstrong died almost 2 years ago.
Seems not that long ago. 56 past the hour, John Metaxas in for Gordon Deal. As NFL players continue to get bigger and stronger, place kickers and punters are now having to bulk up to compete at a high level. During the offseason, professional kickers attend a one-week boot camp in Carlsbad, California, to work on cardiovascular exercises, weightlifting, and kicking. And Wall Street Journal reporter Stu Wu joins us with an inside look at this convention for NFL kickers. So, Stu, what's going on here?
For the past 3 years, about roughly between half a dozen to 10 NFL kickers and punters have gone to this training camp, this one-week boot camp in Carlsbad, California, to work with each other, as well as a former NFL kicking great named John Carney, who played with the Chargers, Saints, and several other teams. And they go there, and despite playing for different teams, they help each other. They trade tips of the trade, how to kick and punt better. The thing about NFL kickers and punters is that they're so different than any other position in football. Their jobs are way more tenuous than that of any other position. If you're a quarterback and you're having a bad year, at least statistically, you can blame it on your bad receivers or your bad offensive line. If you're a kicker, it's either you make the kick or you don't. And if you have a bad week, a bad game, they'll bring another kicker to replace you because that kicker doesn't need to learn a new playbook or anything. All he has to do is make field goals. So these guys not only understand the stress of what it's like to be an NFL kicker or punter, they also understand the mechanics. Most teams don't actually have a kicking coach. They have a special team coach that works on blocking punts and kicks and defending against and just regular special teams plays, but they don't understand anything about kicking itself. So for many of these guys, this week they spend in California together is going to be the best resource they have all year.
Can you go into some of the tips that they give each other?
Some of these tips are going to be really nerdy. Steve Hauschka, who just won the Super Bowl with the Seattle Seahawks, said one tip he learned is to kick the ball with the laces facing toward him. And most of the time, if the hold and the snap is perfect, you want the laces facing outward towards where you're kicking the field goes. But not everything's going to be perfect, so sometimes it's good to practice an imperfect kick. Another tip that one punter learned was that when he catches a football, he let it come into his chest. But because of where his face mask is placed, he can't actually see the football until the moment before he kicks it. So you want to catch it out in front of your body and drop it in front of your hands. Some guys were doing something called overstriding, where their steps were too big, and that changes the plane of your kick. Am I even speaking English right here? I mean, these are things that only an NFL or maybe a college kicker would understand.
Or even a fan. Thanks, Stu. Stu Wu of the Wall Street Journal. That about does it for this week's edition of the Wall Street Journal This Weekend. For Gina Cervetti, I'm John Metaxas, in for Gordon Deal.
Hi, I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business called Podlexing, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. With so many job boards out there, how can you know which one will produce the best talent? Realistically, to fill the position fast and with the perfect candidate, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can do it with a single click with ZipRecruiter.com. ZipRecruiter.com lets you post to more than 40 job sites at once. ZipRecruiter.com also posts your job on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter. Just post once and watch the qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. You can screen applicants, rate them, and hire the right people fast. Try ZipRecruiter free right now and find out why it's been used by over 100,000 businesses. And right now, listeners of this program can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. One more time, to try ZipRecruiter for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ.